to Earth Matters. This is Donna Stevens, Executive Director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, and your host for today's program on Gila Members Community Radio, KURU at 89.1 FM. Today's show is about a really important issue impacting our national forests, cattle grazing and voluntary grazing buyouts. Joining me here in the studio to talk about this is Madeline Carey, the Gila Campaign Fellow with Wild Earth Guardians in Santa Fe. Welcome, Madeline.
Thanks for having me, Donna. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I'm really glad to have you here. I mean, I've been interested in grazing on public lands for a really, really long time, and it's an issue that a lot of people don't know that much about or don't want to talk about. But we are going to talk about it here today.
Yes, we are.
So first, can you start out by giving us some history on cattle grazing in the western United States and on our national forests?
Sure. Well, public lands ranching really took off after the Civil War because of the relatively small amount of capital that was needed compared to the possible returns. It was a really financially lucrative opportunity for a lot of individuals coming out of the antebellum South. You basically just needed some cattle and a few cowboys to move them around when necessary. The majority of the western range was open, and you could only claim on a homestead just over 1,000 acres. Most outfits would move their cattle from summer to winter pastures, but it wasn't uncommon for ranchers to just turn their cattle out and leave them out on the range year-round and only round them up once a year to send them to market. By 1870, there are about 4.1 million cattle and 4.8 million sheep on the public range, which was already showing signs of being severely overgrazed, which the ranchers and cattlemen recognized. And during the 1880s, they worked to remedy this as barbed wire became readily available. And there's a statistic that I think in the 1880s, there was enough barbed wire strung up across the western United States to reach the moon and back.
Wow.
But this didn't really help. Range health continued to deteriorate, and by the year 1900, there were 19.6 million beef cattle and 25.1 million sheep grazing the western range, which is a lot of animals.
So when you say the western range, you don't just mean what are now public lands?
No, I mean, because there were several states, including New Mexico, that weren't part of the Union at that point.
Oh, okay.
So it was anywhere, and largely anywhere and everywhere. And because this was during the westward expansion and homesteading was actively occurring, and people were moving out and staking the claim to the land that the federal government promised them through the Homestead Act, it was way more land and acreage than what is currently in our national forests or our BLM public lands. So then during the Great Depression and the drought that came along with that, Congress finally passed what's called the Taylor Grazing Act, or the TGA, which was passed in 1936. And that ended access to the free range. And it was intended to improve the health of the public lands as well as stabilize the cattle industry. Because the cattle industry was dependent on the health of the rangelands, it was really victim to any periodic droughts. And the Dust Bowl is sort of the iconic drought that really negatively impacted the industry. And so what the TGA did is it permitted grazing on 80 million acres of previously unappropriated and unreserved federal lands in the West. And what was then the Grazing Service and is now the BLM distributed permits. And priority was given to ranchers who had previously ranched the lands now that were now being regulated. In addition, those who had private land and water resources where cattle could be grazed during times when they were not on the allotments, ranchers were also given priority during the initial permitting process. And because the ranchers had been using the public lands prior to the permitting system for so long, many of them felt that they owned these lands, even though that legally wasn't true. And that has subsequently created a misunderstanding about exactly what a grazing permit is. Permits are revocable licenses that do not create any right, title, interest, or estate in land. Even though they are bought and sold and traded privately as if they are a property right, they're not property rights. And the government has the authority to revoke them whenever they see fit.
So that would be what, Forest Service and BLM?
Yeah, exactly. And then in the 1970s, we sort of saw changing public values and attitudes towards public lands. It was an increasing mostly urban American population that was using public lands more for recreation than they were for subsistence. And this raised a lot of questions about the environmental harm being caused by grazing and the continued destruction of the range, despite the supposed oversight that was involved in the permitting process. In 1976, the Federal Land Policy Management Act was passed, or FLPMA as it's affectionately known, which phased out the Homesteading Act and famously closed the American West. And it introduced the concept of managing public lands for multiple uses, which is the mandate of the federal land agencies today. And that's something you hear thrown around a lot, is the multiple use doctrine. Mm-hmm. And that recognized that this increasingly urban population wanted to have access for their lands, for their wilderness, their beauty, and their recreational opportunities, not just for forage for their cattle. And specifically, FLPMA sets the goal of preserving public lands in as natural a state as possible, which is an interesting mandate because today over 90% of BLMs and over 65% of Forest Service lands are permitted for livestock, including many of our wilderness areas.
Can you say those numbers again, please?
Yes, about over 90% of BLM lands and over 65% of Forest Service lands are permitted for livestock. And this amounts to about 525 million acres in the American West, not including Alaska. And 525 million acres is slightly more than a quarter of the landmass of the continental United States.
And you said that there's cattle grazing in wilderness. I think it's kind of a common misperception that there aren't cattle in wilderness areas.
No, that was the big part of getting the Wilderness Act passed, was that was a place we really had to give and allow cattle grazing in wilderness areas.
Yeah.
And there have been continuous efforts to change the status quo on that.
So cattle grazing is a privilege and not a right.
Yes, that is absolutely correct.
So because if the agencies can revoke it, if there's damage, I'm assuming that would be why they would revoke grazing privileges, if there's damage occurring?
Yes. Theoretically, the agencies are supposed to be keeping tabs on the health of the range and the allotments, and if they get degraded or too damaged, they are to close them to grazing, although it is rare that you see that. There was just a big lawsuit up in Idaho about a month ago where the BLM actually closed some allotments because they felt that it was too dry, they weren't getting enough water, and the cattle were really, really impacting the health of both the range and the watersheds that overlay that area. And the ranchers took them to court and lost, and the judge basically upheld the BLM's right to do that and to manage public lands in a way that ensures the environmental health.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk a bit about the costs, the financial costs, that is, not the ecological costs. We'll get to that, too, of cattle grazing. And I wanted to ask you how much public lands ranchers have to pay for the privilege of grazing cattle on land that's owned by all Americans.
So ranchers pay $1.35 per AUM to graze on federal lands.
And an AUM is?
It stands for Animal Unit Month. And it's sort of a funny unit of measure, but an animal unit is generally considered to be a cow with or without an unweaned calf. And an animal unit month is how much forage would be needed to sustain this animal or the animal and her calf for a month, which is it's about 26 pounds of forage per day is the math. But this was done. An interesting fact about this is that calculation for forage was done based on a 1,000-pound animal. But the pre-slaughter weight of cows has increased 300 pounds since the grazing fee was set.
Really?
So it's likely that they need to do the genetics and breeding and preference for body types in the beef market. It's likely that they're actually eating more than 26 pounds of forage per day.
$1.35 a month. I mean, I couldn't feed a gerbil on that.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. So, for example, if a rancher had 200 head of cattle, they'd pay $3,240 a year to graze their cattle on public lands. And that comes out to $16.20 an animal per year, which is about what it would cost you or I to buy 5 pounds of ground beef at the supermarket.
Yeah. Well, so in addition to the really cheap grazing fees that public lands ranchers pay, They also get all kinds of government subsidies. Can you talk about those a little bit?
Yeah, and I'm actually going to start by talking about the grazing fee a little bit more. And the grazing fee is held at an artificially low level through some interesting pieces of policy, as well as variables in the fee. And that's a major source of the subsidies. The grazing fee was originally enacted because the federal government wanted to sort of mimic what it would cost to pay to graze cattle on private lands. Mm-hmm. Or state lands. And if you look at state grazing fees around the West, they're much, much higher than the federal fee. And the federal fee takes into account three things. One is what would be the cost to pasture cattle on private rangelands. And then it includes variables for the sale price of livestock and the cost of livestock production. And when this fee was being negotiated during the 60s and 70s, the industry lobbied very hard, the beef industry, to include the cost of production of livestock as well as the sale price, because it helps insulate ranchers from any fluctuations in the market. And President Reagan signed an executive order saying that $1.35 was the lowest the fee could go, and it could not increase by more than 25% each year. After he signed that executive order, the fee increased for four straight years, and then they tweaked some portions of a linear regression model, and they tweak some pieces of it, and the grazing fee has not gone above, I think, $1.46 since 1992.
No kidding.
And it's been at $1.35 for many years.
So it doesn't matter what inflation does to all the other prices, that stays pretty much the same.
Yes. So if it was scaled even just to account for inflation or to be adjusted for inflation, it would be $2.93 per AUM in today's dollars. Mm-hmm. So that's when we talk about the subsidized beef industry or a subsidized public lands ranching. That is a major aspect of it, is they're not even paying in today's dollars to graze their cattle on the land. Additionally, there is a lot of federal dollars available for what are called conservation improvements to their allotments that are generally water source improvements or manipulations to install troughs and pipes that do help keep cattle out of the delicate riparian areas, which is an area that they damage a lot during their grazing. But it also affects the hydrology of the allotments in the way the natural water flows across the land. So conservation isn't really the best term for the improvements they're doing. It is sort of livestock benefiting improvements.
Right.
And additionally, they're able to collect disaster subsidies. So if there is a big drought, or last fall we had big snows up in a northern part of the state, and a lot of cattle froze to death, the rancher is able to go in and apply and get money or livestock indemnity payments, livestock disaster payments for any unforeseen consequences that might affect their ability to make money. And this is one of the few industries where that really happened. You know, you could equate it to maybe the bailouts of banks on Wall Street. It's sort of a similar, you know, if something really goes wrong in your business, the government is there to just help you out and pull you along. And with ranching, unlike with banking, your potential gains for the amount of financial risk you assume are pretty low these days, now that the range isn't just open. It's a very different game than it was immediately post-Civil War. And then on top of all of that, the production of cattle feed is heavily subsidized, and that sort of gets into a different area when we're talking about agricultural subsidies. But it's very cheap and easy to grow corn and soy in this country. And that keeps feed for cattle when they are not out grazing, or any supplemental feed for them, readily available at a very low cost compared to, you know, if you were feeding thousands of gerbils, it would cost you a lot of money compared to what it costs to feed thousands of cows.
Okay. Wow. I had no idea. It's even worse than I thought. So we will be right back after this short break to continue our discussion with Madeline Carey here on Earth Matters. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. If you're just joining us, I'm Donna Stevens, the Executive Director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, and I'm your host for today's program. Joining me today is Gila Campaign Fellow Madeline Carey of Wild Earth Guardians, and we are talking about public lands grazing and voluntary grazing buyouts. So right before the break, we were talking about some of the subsidies that ranchers get. And of course, these are subsidies that are paid for by you, taxpayers. And we talked about how the grazing fees are artificially low. And now I wanted to switch just a little bit and talk about some of the ecological impacts of cattle grazing.
Wow. Well, this is a big topic.
Yes. Yes, it is.
And I'll start with something that really matters to all of us and I think is on everyone's mind this week with the Gila diversion, and that's water. Cattle are the number one source of non-point source pollution in the western U.S., and that means non-point source pollution is runoff pollution, so any toxins or particulates that are picked up in water as it runs over the surface of the land, things that aren't toxic spills from pipes. And this really comes from two things. One, cattle pooping in the water, which if you've ever been out hiking, you've probably been along a stream and you've probably seen some cow pies a little too close to where you're going to pump your water out later. And two, cattle remove and trample vegetation as they move about the landscape and as they eat. And this damages the soil and spreads invasive weeds and introduces a lot of particulate matter into waterways that we wouldn't otherwise see. And it also increases erosion, which changes the nature of many watersheds. And this damage occurs really high up in the watersheds. And so the trickle down and sort of accumulation effects, is it magnifies everything.
You mean trickle down really does work?
Yeah. It
Who
does.
Knew?
You know, it's starting way up in a little tiny tributary of the Gila River, and eventually it's going to, you know, end up in a much more substantial channel. And it's happening in every single little tributary of mm-hmm. our river systems. And so the net effect is really, really impressive. Former Secretary Interior Bruce Babbitt has written that federal public lands livestock grazing is the most damaging use of public lands. And worldwide, most arid climates, like what we live in southwestern New Mexico, don't have large native grazers. And even the American bison occurred sporadically in the arid parts of the American West. And a lot of times you hear the argument, well, cattle have taken the place of bison. And that might be true back in the Great American Grasslands where bison were found in large herds, but there were not a lot of bison wandering around the Gila. And in areas where cattle grazing is prevalent, there's a lot of loss of both vegetative cover and diversity, which impacts the species, and mostly smaller rodent species that are really the base of your food chain. And it can drive some of them to extinction or to endangered or threatened status. And then, of course, there's the impact on our carnivores. And that has been a very contentious issue in this region for many years. And that's the reintroduction of the Mexican wolf. And you know, ranching with carnivores present on the landscape is challenging. But the industry and the culture of the industry has been really threatening to the Mexican wolf's recovery. And there are many projects working to minimize that impact. But you can't talk about impacts of cattle grazing without talking about the fact that the industry basically drove us to extirpate most of our large carnivores off the landscape in the early part of the 1900s.
It's interesting to me that some of the information that I see from people who are anti-wolf says stuff like, preserve our Western environment. And I think, well, if you really take that argument back to its logical conclusion, Sorry, that would mean no cattle, because as you said, bison weren't even particularly widespread right here, and there certainly were wolves.
Yes.
And so some of those arguments don't really hold up once you examine them. And not very deeply either. So I don't want to put you on the spot too much by asking you to predict the future, but I wonder if you could just talk about how drought and climate change, you know, how they will affect grazing and forest conditions in the future. And it's already happening, really.
Yeah. Well, isn't everyone's favorite game to predict the future? And I wish I had a more cheery message to bring, but Drought and climate change will only intensify the impacts of grazing. The Southwest is predicted to become hotter and drier, which will limit forage growth, and the health of our watersheds will become increasingly important in order to provide enough water for our growing population. And the watershed piece is really important because as more and more people need water, we really are going to need every bit of clean water we can, and we're going to need our watersheds to be functioning in the way that they are have evolved to function, which cattle really impact their ability to do that. And we actually see a loss of water production in areas where you have increased erosion from cattle grazing. And coupled with that, there is likely to be we're going to continue to see erratic wildfire behavior, which coupled with grazing causes a lot more erosion on the watershed. So when things get hotter and drier, it's harder for the grass to grow, and the cattle are likely to really eliminate a lot of forage off the range.
You were saying something earlier about some of the subsidies that grazers, that ranchers get, and one of them was for water developments and for piping and troughs and that kind of stuff. And some of those things have sort of become necessary now for wildlife, and they rationalize building those because they say that it's for wildlife benefit. But wildlife were here, you know, for millions of years before there were cattle, and they did fine because we hadn't destroyed our watersheds and streams. And so now that we have, because of cattle grazing and other things as well, now it's sort of necessary to provide water for cattle and for wildlife.
Yeah, and I hear that argument a lot that, oh, these are wildlife water improvements and we're using drinkers for all the birds and, you know, wolves are going to come drink out of the water. They need water too. And like you said, wildlife has been around for a lot longer than we or the cattle have. And they're pretty industrious individuals all the way up the food chain from your little kangaroo rats up to the wolves. They're going to figure it out. And especially if you protect areas like the Gila to ensure that they are large and intact enough that the system can sort of regain and restore all of its working parts, they'll manage. They'll get through the drought. You'll see changes in population trends, but they are much better at living in what nature throws their way than we are.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about why public lands grazing is such a heated issue, why people get so upset over it, and why it's so controversial.
Well, for starters, you're talking about people's livelihoods. Anytime you're critical of the manner in which someone earns their living, you're going to strike a nerve. And you or I would get very up in arms if someone criticized how we do our job. And it kind of happens to me all the time because I'm an easy target. But challenging public lands ranching is challenging the romance of the American West. And, you know, what's more iconic and romantic than the cowboy and his cow pony and the cattle riding off into the sunset? And a culturally accepted truth about the American West is that cattle grazing is essential to the landscape and the Western narrative, which it's not. I mean, I believe it's not. I believe wilderness is much more essential. And the cowboy's become the idealized American. He's hardworking, he's independent, he's adept and good at his job. He's sort of a Renaissance man, if you will. And when you challenge public lands grazing, you're challenging an idealized and romanticized American dream. Change is very hard and emotional, and changing public lands grazing and the narrative around it is going to be very hard and very emotional for a lot of people because you're challenging a really popular paradigm and notion about what it means to live in the American West.
Yeah, well, the whole custom, culture, way of life thing it's a difficult one for me because the world has changed and we have to change along with it. I mean, there's so many people now that we can't just do the things we did in the 1850s or even 1950s. And, I mean, custom, culture, way of life, well, how far back are we going to go? Slavery? Child labor? I mean, you know, we have to do what's going to work for the majority of people.
And for me, you know, talking about ranching and the agricultural lifestyle, I grew up riding horses, and I'm a devoted horsewoman and equestrian. And I really identify with these people that love being out working with their animals and really love the lifestyle. But for me, it comes down to being a good neighbor and to how big you're willing to make your neighborhood. I don't want to live my life in a way that prevents someone else from enjoying the way they live theirs. And so if you can ranch in a way that isn't going to damage the land and prevent the wolves from coming back, I'm so grateful to have you, your presence in my neighborhood, in my community, and in our state. But as soon as it becomes a thing where you're saying it's my way, I'm right, this is how it has to be, this is how it's always been, that's where I run into, you know, a bigger issue on the customs and culture thing. I don't, you know, I think change has to come from all sides, mm-hmm. and we all have to support each other through it, because it is really challenging to change your ways.
It is. It's tough. And we tend to think of the Gila National Forest permittees as people who've grown up here and have, you know, their ranch has been in their family for generations. But last time that you were here in Silver City, Madeline, you showed me a map of grazing permits and ranches in the Gila National Forest that have changed owners in the last, I don't know, 10 years? I forget now.
It was a decade, yes.
Okay. Can you talk about how the ranch ownership is changing?
Yeah. And first, I'm just going to address this notion of generations and put sort of a time frame on it. You look at the Gila, it was one of the last places in the American West to really be settled by Anglos, mostly because the Chiricahua Apache were so fierce, and many of you are familiar with the notorious legend of Geronimo. But this area was inhabited by very, very fierce, proud warriors and Native Americans up through the late 1800s, which is really different than other parts. So at the most families that have been here, it's just over 100 years or about 125 years. We're not talking about in northern New Mexico, you have Hispanic families that have been ranching since 1600. And that's not true of the Gila region. This is a very recently settled and recently grazed region in comparison to a lot of the West, the rest of the West. But back to the map that I showed you. In the past 10 years, over 50% of the permits in the Gila bioregion, so the Gila National Forest and the Apache Sitgraves National Forest, have changed hands. The average age of a permittee on the Gila National Forest is 66, which speaks to an aging demographic of ranching and sort of the types of individuals who are doing it. And over half of the permittees under the age of 60 have jobs off the ranch to help support themselves. There's been a big increase in ranching as a second career, which we're able to see through looking at some economic trends and changes in per capita income versus jobs versus wages. And there's also been and a lot of these ranchers have had a lifestyle, are looking for a lifestyle and enjoyment rather than economic gains. And they usually have had another career or are collecting retirement, perhaps from the military or some other job. And they've really come out to live in a wild place and enjoy the romantic cowboy dream.
Let's talk about that some more after the break. Stay with us, please. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM with Donna Stevens. That's me, your host for today's show. And joining me is Madeline Carey of Wild Earth Guardians. And we are continuing our discussion about public lands grazing and voluntary grazing buyouts. Well, we haven't gotten to that part yet, but we will. There's a lot of background here. And just before the break, Madeline was telling me about a trend in ranch ownership in the Gila National Forest. And I wanted to talk about why so many ranchers are selling out. And I mean selling out, like selling their ranch. I don't mean it in the other way of what selling out means. So what are some of the obstacles and problems that ranchers face with their cattle on our forests?
Well, drought is a major one. This summer was a rare one in terms of the amount of precipitation we got. We're in a chronic drought cycle, and there's a lot of science actually that indicates the past 60 or so years in this region were uncharacteristically moist and wet. And the Gila has an average rainfall of about 15 inches, which means you could have years where you get 25 inches and years where you get 5. And in those years where you get 5, it's going to be a lot harder to raise cattle to sufficient weight to send them to market. And you're going to have to spend a lot more money on supplemental feed. And it's hard to predict that. And because cattle prices fluctuate and go up and down, it's hard to know when you're going to be in the red and when you're going to be in the black. This, coupled with severe wildfires this region has seen, has really impacted the range health and range capacity and how many cattle can be out on the range. And that makes it a really hard go for ranchers. And in general, ranching is a high-stakes gamble. I talked about it before. Compared to other careers or businesses where you assume a lot of risk, the financial rewards are pretty low. And, you know, that's some complicated economics someone showed me, so I won't get too much more into that. But another obstacle is that ranchers are required to manage their cattle in a way that does not impact the numerous endangered species that live in the Gila. And in particular, the wolf, but there's several fish as well as many plants. And it does make it hard for the ranchers. It requires much more active management.
So how do grazing permits work? How do you get one? That sort of thing. How are they? What's the oversight like?
The grazing permits, well, they're hard to get. They're competitive. Most lands that are available and most permits that are open are owned by someone. And permits will authorize a certain number of cattle on the lands. And each year, the Forest Service will issue what are called annual operating instructions for the permittee. And the annual operating instructions are supposed to allow the Forest Service and the permittee to come up with a plan to manage their lands in a way that will account for these drought cycles or for wildfires, or if you have wolves that come in and are denning, it will help both the ranchers and the Forest Service work together to manage the lands. And every 10 years, they have to reauthorize the permits, which means they go through a big environmental review, and they check to make sure the range is in adequate health to support an adequate number of cattle. And there is a lot of controversy over how many cattle the Forest Service authorizes. I've actually spoken with some ranchers in the Gila who think the Forest Service tends to overauthorize and allow too many cattle on certain permits in the Gila, and that they actually think that they are able to be a more productive and economically viable ranch by understocking their permitted numbers.
So they are allowed to do that?
Yes. The only major caveat is if you own a grazing permit, there is a minimum stocking number on that permit, and so you have to have that many cattle, which the environmental community has sort of struggled with, and you have had several environmental groups that have purchased permits and have suddenly found themselves in the wild world of cattle ranching,
right?
Which has been interesting and made for some interesting jobs.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, about the grazing buyout issue, because, well, you just brought that up, how people have bought allotments or bought permits for an allotment, and then they find themselves being ranchers. So how does the whole grazing buyout thing work?
Well, permit buyout is a tested and proven conservation strategy, and it's a little bit of a misnomer, and there are actually two avenues you can go down. One is where you purchase the permit and you actually own a permit and are ranching cattle. And this is happened around the Grand Canyon. If you drive into the Grand Canyon, you see the cattle. All those permits are actually owned by a conservation group, as are the cattle. But what Guardians is doing is we still call it buyout, but it's actually compensation for ranchers to waive their permits back to the Forest Service. And so we sit down and we talk to district rangers and we talk to ranchers and we try and sort of strategically identify some allotments where the environmental consequences of cattle grazing are really high. They're generally difficult allotments to manage and difficult allotments to ranch on. Sometimes there'll be big elevational differences, or road access will make it difficult to care for and watch over your cattle. And so once we've identified an allotment that the Forest Service will agree to close, we then negotiate a price with the rancher and we write them a check and they waive their permit back to the Forest Service.
So is it permanently retired, or
not yet.
Does the Forest Service do with it?
So there's two types of closures. There is what's called an administrative closure, which is currently what we've been working on in the Gila. And that is where the Forest Service agrees to close the permit for the term of a grazing lease, which would be those 10 years that we talked about. And they will not reopen it until they do a full environmental analysis and ensure that grazing will not impact any of the endangered species living on the allotment. Our ideal world is what we do a congressional closure, which would require an act of Congress. And this is something we're working on, but it's really essential for us to get done in order for buyout to have the intended ecological impacts that we'd like it to have. And that's where Congress would authorize a piece of legislation saying if a permittee comes to a forest and says, I'd like to close my allotment, the allotment will be closed permanently. And how, because of how public lands management is set up and who has authority over what, only Congress can issue final decisions on public lands management. And so we're working currently in Congress to get a piece of legislation through that will set up a mechanism for ranchers to come into their forests and say, I'd like to close this allotment.
So then would they be compensated for how much money they would have made if they were?
No, it's just a one-time deal. And we have our own algorithm that sort of, for us, weights the biodiversity as well as the other environmental importance of the allotment. Mm-hmm. And there's actually a really neat program out of New Mexico State that's called RANVAL, which is an Excel program that lets you look at the value of ranches, looking at all the different things from their allotments to associated elk hunting permits to any real estate development, including factors in location to major economic centers. And so we use those two factors as well as the current real estate market to negotiate with the ranchers. Even though we're only paying them to waive their permit, we're not purchasing any of their private land or property.
So when you buy out a permit, you're buying it out essentially for the 10-year period or however many years they have left on their permit.
It will be for 10 years from when it's closed. So there, when we sign a closure agreement, there's a date at which the rancher has to remove the cattle, and it'll be from that date 10 years on. It won't be, it's not for the duration of what their permit's authorized for. Okay. It's a hard and fast 10-year closure.
Okay. So the way that it's set up right now, because there aren't any bills that have passed Congress, the Forest Service, after those 10 years and after they do a thorough environmental analysis, could sell that permit to someone else? Is that right?
They could reopen it. That is a possibility. And that's why we're not really looking at administrative closures as a good long-term solution, because we are leveraging a lot of conservation investors' dollars. It's expensive to do these buyouts. Mm-hmm. Permits are expensive, even if you're just purchasing them to graze cattle on. And that's why we're really going after the congressional option, because it's a much more, well, it is permanent, and it's a much more achievable, or it makes our goal of sort of alleviating stress from cattle grazing much more achievable, because you're ensuring that certain portions of the land will be closed permanently.
So are there precedents for grazing permit buyouts in parts of the West?
Yes. Most notably, its buyout has been used to protect some lands around Yellowstone and the Grand Canyon, as I mentioned earlier. But recently, in the past 5 years, Congress has authorized several permit retirement programs. One is in the California Desert Conservation Area, which was for sheep grazing allotments. And they have also done a piece of legislation for sheep grazing allotments across bighorn sheep range across the American West, mostly because of disease conflict between bighorn sheep and domestic sheep. That's a major, actually, sportsman's concern, because it's very mm-hmm. easy for those two species to transmit diseases. And it's also been employed in larger land protection packages in the Owe Canyon lands in Idaho and the Cascade Siskiyou National Monument in Oregon.
So have there been any buyouts in the Gila National Forest?
There have. We did our first one in April, and it was very exciting. We worked with the rancher on the Deep Creek allotment, which is up near Glenwood, and that allotment had five endangered species living on it, or has five endangered species living on it, has a wolf den that has been intermittently active for the past several years. It had some major wildfire impacts from whitewater baldy, both from the actual burn and then from runoff associated with those fire scars. Mm-hmm. And it sort of is across the front of a mountain range, and there's a lower part and an upper part. And it's a really challenging allotment to ranch. And you talk to a lot of people in the area, and even the Forest Service said, you know, that was a really hard one to manage just because it's so hard to move your cattle around on the allotment.
Mm-hmm. So when you did that buyout, was the Forest Service supportive of that? And what is their position on this generally, not specifically with Deep Creek even? But
generally, it's really varied, which I think is a good general statement about buyout. across multiple groups of people. But with the Forest Service, you know, in the Gila, we have some district rangers who are supportive and really see it as a management tool in a way that they can work with problem allotments and alleviate some stressors and make other allotments more productive. And we have some district rangers who really see it as an attack on the ranching industry, and there are individuals who grew up in big ranching families and are not yet comfortable with it.
But the permittees voluntarily gave their permit up.
Yes.
I mean, nobody forced them to do it.
This is entirely voluntary. We essentially send out letters explaining what we're doing, and I sit around and wait for people to call me and talk to me about their permits. And then usually I get to go out and meet with them, and a lot of them are really lovely individuals that like to drive me around and show me their fences that they've built mm-hmm. and where their cattle get water and the high water marks from all the rains this summer. But yeah, it's entirely voluntary. We're not forcing anyone. There is the economic incentive of receiving a large lump sum of cash that can help pay out outstanding debts or allow you to retire quite comfortably. But yeah, it's a really important factor is that it's totally voluntary.
Right. Yeah, I wish somebody would give me a giant lump sum of cash. I could use that. So we'll talk some more about that after our break. So please stay with us here on Earth Matters. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. This is Donna Stevens, the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance Director and your host for today's program. Joining me here in the studio is Gila Campaign Fellow Madeline Carey of Wild Earth Guardians, and we are talking about public lands grazing and voluntary grazing buyouts in the Gila National Forests and other national forests. So we've talked a little bit about the financial incentive for ranchers to retire their allotments, and I wanted to ask you if a lot of the ranchers have been receptive to this idea.
Well, my proud statistic I like to say is I've increased rancher interest by 300% in the program. there's a letter sent out in 2012, and we received two positive responses and one negative response. We sent one out in September to sort of query interest and let ranchers know about this program, and we've had six positive responses so far.
So you follow up and talk to the ranchers to see if they're
interested. And a lot of them, what's been really cool this round is we've had a lot of ranchers who aren't actually interested in selling their permit, but they're interested in seeing the program be offered. And that's really key when we're working with Congress, because we don't want it to – we really need the support of the ranching community, and we need individuals who sort of get that there are parts of the Gila that are so vulnerable and have been grazed for so long that it really benefits everyone to take cattle off of them. There are allotments that it's hard to make money grazing, and that the impacts of having cattle there is just such a high cost to the ecosystem that it really is in everyone's best interest, from the ranchers to the Forest Service to the general public to the conservation community, to close those allotments. And that's been really cool this time around, is to meet with the ranchers and talk with them, and they really get it. They're really intelligent individuals that are really invested in protecting our wild places.
Well, and you were saying earlier in the show that the average age of a grazing permittee was that, I forget if that was in the Gila only, is 66.
Yes.
So it seems to me that, I mean, this is hard work. We're not talking about sitting at your desk looking at your computer screen. We're talking about being out there in all kinds of weather, and it's tough work. And so it seems to me that as people age, they would be more interested in returning their permit to the Forest Service and getting a big buyout.
And that is where we see a lot of interest. Another demographic of interested ranchers are exactly the individuals you just mentioned. They're people who are aging and are having a hard time physically doing the day-to-day labor that's required to ranch cattle. And a big trend across agriculture nationwide, not just in the Gila and not just in cattle grazing, is a lack of interest from youth and from young people. And they're much more interested in moving to cities where there are jobs that aren't as physically demanding and are more financially lucrative or stable. And a lot of these ranchers don't want to see, you know, they're looking and they're like, I don't want to see anyone else's cattle out there. Like, this is my allotment that I've been ranching on since the 40s. And that's what makes buyout attractive to them, is that they sort of know that as long as they're the ones that are going to ride off into the sunset with this allotment. Mm-hmm. And it gives them, I think, some closure and a sense of security to know that they are the ones that will have been the final ranchers on this piece of land.
So recently I picked up a Katrin Courier, which is a fairly conservative little paper. And I was really surprised to see an article in there by none other than Madeline Carey. And it was about grazing buyouts in the Gila National Forest. It was kind of a short article. And, I mean, I'm not saying that because that article was in the Courier that they endorsed that point of view, but the fact that they published it means something, at least.
Yeah, it was really exciting for me to get that article published because buyout is really only a small part of what Guardians is trying to do in the region. As I hopefully many of you know, but if you don't, the Gila is the landscape that originally inspired the wilderness movement, which is both a uniquely American ideal, but has been really fundamental in changing land conservation worldwide. The Gila is the world's first designated wilderness area. It turns 90 this year. And Aulo Leopold was this unique visionary who imagined these big wilderness reserves set aside where you could go on a two-week pack trip and not see any signs of man and really have that unique spiritual and emotional connection to these wild places. And Guardian's big vision for the Gila is to honor Leopold's legacy and honor his vision for having a really big, a really wild, and really intact landscape that has all of its wolves around, that has its elk, that is a place where sportsmen and hikers and paddlers and runners and horsemen and people who like to just go on bird watching hikes can all go out and really enjoy, and ranchers, you know, include them. They love the wildness. And so it was exciting to me to get that article published because I think it's giving us access to talk to people in the region about this incredibly majestic resource that they have that's really a crown jewel in a series of protected areas along the spine of the continent. Mm-hmm. A lot of my job, part of it's the grazing permit buyout, but a lot of it is sort of trying to get people excited and invested in honoring Leopold's legacy in protecting the Gila as a big wild place.
So is that what it means to be a Gila campaign fellow, which is your original title?
I know, it's kind of a mouthful. Because I work with agencies and they have acronyms, I joke that I'm the GCF. But
right. And that they're trying to figure out what their acronym
exactly,
is. That's GCF.
Exactly. Yeah, so Guardians has many campaigns and programs throughout the West, and some of them have their own specific staff person, and I am the specific staff person for the Gila. And it's really exciting because I'm here for 2 years and I'm working full time on the Gila, which is this amazingly beautiful and wild and exciting place. And we're really working to, you know, as I said many times before, further Leopold's vision for the region and for wilderness in general. And this is the place where wilderness started 90 years ago. And the Wilderness Act turned 50 this year. And there's been a lot of discussion about the relevance and the meaning of wilderness in the 21st century and dealing with people like myself who are millennials who supposedly don't like going outside,
right,
away from their screens, which I disagree with. But I think the Gila is a great place to renew the conversation on wilderness and what it means to us as a community and as a state and as a country to have these big, wild, protected areas where we have all of our species. We have our carnivores, we have our keystone species, we have our birds, we have our fish. And so the Gila Campaign Fellow is someone who is working on all aspects, part of which is grazing permit buyout, part of which is education about wilderness, and part of which is outreach to local officials to work with our federally elected representatives to bring us greater protection for this amazing and beautiful place.
We've talked a lot on Earth Matters recently about wilderness because of the anniversaries that you mentioned, the 90th of the Gila Wilderness Area, the 50th of the passage of the Wilderness Act. And those are both that's a big deal. They're both a pretty big deal and very visionary processes and individuals who were instrumental in making those things happen. And since we're talking about grazing on this show, I wanted to ask about, we touched on this a tiny bit earlier, grazing cattle in wilderness areas. So you were saying that in order to get the Wilderness Act passed, that compromise had to be written into there, that we would grandfather in grazing mm-hmm. in wilderness areas. So how in the Gila, in particular, the Gila wilderness area and the Aldo Leopold and the Blue, there still is grazing in those wilderness areas?
In some parts, there have actually been several successful environmental and conservation efforts to remove cattle from those areas, although there are the allotments in the wilderness boundaries, allotment boundaries and wilderness boundaries don't match up exactly. So you do have some allotments that are partially in wilderness and partially out of wilderness.
Okay.
And there's actually kind of a funny problem in the Gila. There is a fairly substantially sized band of feral cattle, which are cattle that have escaped from allotments and from herds and have all banded together. And they're goofy looking, if you've ever seen them. They have these short, stubby legs and these big, buggy eyes. And there's the forest just authorized a roundup of them this fall, which is actually a complicated issue because they technically belong to the state because they are wildlife,
right?
And which they're not, but that's how they're federal, they're discussed in policy. And so it's this complicated go-between of getting permissions. And if any of them die during the roundup, you have to pay the state money, even though, yeah, it's goofy, even though they're not really worth a lot of money and don't grow a lot of, they don't have a lot of muscle on them. So that's an interesting and unique problem to the Gila wilderness, is removing not just the legally authorized cattle, but also dealing with our population of feral cattle, which they believe is over 100.
That's what I was just going to ask you, if we have an estimate. So if an individual goes out there and sees a feral cow, are we allowed to shoot him and eat him for dinner?
No, don't shoot it. You'll go to jail. The state of New Mexico will get very mad at you. Yeah, you're not allowed to shoot them, which is... in the part of the Gila that they're in, which is sort of to the northwest of the cliff dwellings, is really hard to get into. And because you're not allowed to have motorized vehicles in the wilderness, mm-hmm. the cowboys that go out there and do these roundups must be some pretty tough individuals. Because you've got to do the old-fashioned, like, roping your cattle and moving them all into pens. There's none of, you can't shoot them, even though they're likely to go to a sale and get slaughtered anyways.
Right.
But don't shoot them, because they find a dead cow, someone's going to be in trouble.
Yeah. I think they could get people to pay to go on a cattle roundup and, you know, pretend like they're cowboys.
I'll let you
suggest
that to the Forest Service.
So is that happening right now, the roundups?
I am not sure exactly where the time frame stands. I know the paperwork got filed in the Silver City office in late September, and I think the weather's been pretty good so far, so they can get up there. They had to wait for the rain to stop and hopefully get in there before the snow goes. I don't encourage you to go looking for them, because these cattle are known to be very aggressive. And
I just think it's kind of funny. It was just tangent there.
Oh, yeah.
But let's get back to a program that you're going to give on Thursday, the November 13th. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. I'm presenting at the Silver City Museum, and I'm going to talk about both the history and tradition of wilderness in New Mexico and in the Gila, and Guardian's vision and plans for carrying it forward. A little bit more substantial information on what I just touched on here, as well as talk about one aspect of the Gila that really drew me to be interested in working here, which is my birthday wolf, which I'm not going to tell you that story now. So if you want to hear about my birthday wolf, you should come to the presentation on Thursday.
At what time?
It's at noon.
At noon at Silver City Museum.
Yes.
Okay, on November 13th?
Yes.
So you're going to talk... Are you also going to be talking about grazing permit
buyouts? Yes, I'm going to talk about grazing permit buyout, and I'd be happy to answer questions if people have them, and because that is a method or a technique we're using to sort of further our vision for the region.
Can you tell us in about 2 minutes what your other vision for the region is?
In about 2 minutes? Well, we envision a Gila that is wild and is, as Aldo Leopold found it, full of its native carnivores and open to all members of the American public to enjoy and experience this really unique American ideal that is having wild places that are protected for us to go connect emotionally, physically, spiritually with things that are not built by man.
That was pretty succinct.
I'm working on it.
So if people want to hear more, they should show up.
Absolutely. Or if they have questions. I don't live down here. I do spend a lot of time down here, so I love to hear comments and concerns from the people that are living and breathing the stuff that we're working on.
So we just have a couple of minutes left, but I just wanted to ask if there are any other things that concerned citizens can do if they care about what's going on in the forest with grazing impacts.
You should advocate and engage. Public lands are public, and there are systems in place to allow the public the opportunity to comment and to affect change on how the lands are managed. There are some groups working on coexistence projects with ranching methods. We're working on the grazing permit buyout. And by engaging with your local, state, and national politicians, you really, really support our work by letting them know that the people that live in this region and who use these lands very frequently are really concerned about the impacts that cattle are having. So sit down and have meetings with your county commissioners, write letters to your senators, go talk to the mayor and take them to coffee, take them on a hike and show them a place where you maybe found cattle damage on a stream. But they're public lands and your voice really does matter. So I encourage all of you, if you feel passionate about this issue, to sit down and write a letter and say, we support grazing permit buyout because we think it's a really effective tool for protecting the wildness that exists in the Gila.
So they could let officials at the Forest Service know, the Gila National Forest, mm-hmm. and senators as
and
well?
And Senator Tom Udall and Senator Martin Heinrich, their information's on their website for how to contact them and write them a letter. And I know that they both really are invested in hearing from people, not just only about the Gila, but about all public lands in New Mexico.
Great. Thank you so much, Madeline, for joining me today to talk about grazing and grazing permit buyouts right here. Thanks to our audio engineer and Kuru Guru, Kyle Johnson. And thank you, our listeners, for tuning into this week's program. I'm Donna Stevens. Please join us next week for another edition of Earth Matters here on Gila Members Community Radio.